develops social relationships of production, the relationships of production, the way that people produce, and the way that they communicate. And in particular here, we're talking about an article that I wrote in Meat Magazine called Info Enclosure 2.0, which talks about Web 2.0 and what that means. In network topology, what there's different sort of modes of sharing or ways of information communication, ways of sharing. Right, one way was called client-server. And the distinction about a client-server system is it's a system where you have one centralized server, and everybody that communicates through this server. So when you're sending a message, this message is sent through the central server to whoever you're receiving the message. So there's a point of mediation, right? This point of mediation is the central server, and all relationships are mediated by this central point, right? Then there's also P2P, or peer-based networks. Peer-based networks are when the communication is direct between the peers. So when one node, a node is like an individual person or a server or a computer, communicates directly with another node. The communication is not mediated, right? So the question of mediation is what distinguishes a client-server system from a peer-to-peer system, in that in a peer system, it goes direct, and in a client-server system, it goes through a central server. Now, in political economy, we talk about the state and private property, and we talk about communism, or the a state, sort of a theoretical society in which there's no property and no state, which means the same thing. In a capitalist system, the way that capitalism works is that there's a certain class of direct producers and a certain class of people that take the surplus of the direct producers, right? And the way this is possible is because ownership, property, mediates the relationship between the direct producers, right? So that property exists because the state grants it, because the state has an exclusive control of property in a certain area, and so property owners, by controlling the means of production or the instruments of production, prevent people from being able to produce without them. So they mediate this relationship. Because they mediate the relationship, they're able to capture some of the value. So in a system of direct producers simply sharing, there's no mediation, and in a system of peer-to-peer networks, there's also no mediation. Sorry. I'm getting a little bit confused. Okay, Web 2.0. Web 2.0 is often referred to as a means of sharing, and it comes through Web 2.0. People use sites like YouTube or MySpace, and they upload images or pictures, and these things are shared among them. But the servers that they use, the systems that they use, are centralized systems where they're owned by one person or one organization. And this means that the relationships are always mediated through this system. So for instance, in the early days of the internet, the main technologies were like things like email and Usenet, and the computers talked to each other directly. They didn't have a central point of control. Meanwhile, in the capitalist world, you had things like CompuServe or AOL. The original version of AOL was a centralized system, right? The peer-to-peer nature of the early internet is what enabled things like independent service providers to operate, and enabled things like Usenet to operate, in which images or pictures or text were uploaded and shared around without any centralized point of control, right? And now this is a problem for capitalism, because if there isn't a central point of control, it isn't possible for any organization to sort of extract money or to make money by employing the sense of control, right? So when the web came around, the web is a client-server system. So even though it works on this peer-to-peer system of the internet, it actually is a client-server. So a website has one server, and every browser in that website, every person that looks at that website, has to connect directly to that server. So all of a sudden, this creates the kind of control that capitalism needs to extract money or to get into that relationship, right? And so even though there has been possibility of sharing on the internet for a long time, from the early days, using things like email, which is distributed and peer-to-peer, and Usenet, which is a system of sharing that's been around since 1979, actually since before the internet, it wasn't it wasn't funded, it didn't have a lot of money behind it and a lot of ways to promote it and to propagate its usage until the web came around. And all of a sudden, then you have capitalist investment. And also you have centralized control. Like there are several advantages of a centralized system from the point of view of capitalist investment, right? If you have a system of sharing like Usenet where nobody's in control, there's no way for anybody to stop people from communicating. So you can't really censor or control the information. There's also no way to track them, as we're talking about on privacy, because in a peer-to-peer system, the individual nodes only share as much information with each other as they're configured to share. So if you're sending a message to another person, right, the only data that's being exchanged is the data between you and that other person. Right, if you're using something like Facebook, then the data that you're sending is always mediated through Facebook. So Facebook now is in a position to collect information about you. Not only that, but they're in a position to control what kind of information you can send. Right. So for instance, if you're sending messages that the system doesn't like, then the system can ban you, can bar you, can remove that kind of content. So it's also a question of what the message is, right? So the mediation becomes the message, because what kind of media becomes available on a peer-to-peer network can be radically different than with the kind of information that becomes available on a centralized network, which is what Web 2.0 is about. If you look at Web 2.0, why is it called Web 2.0? Right, Web 1.0 isn't any fundamentally technically different from Web 2.0. The difference is in the business model. In the first sort of evolution of the internet, the capitalist investment first came in to sort of like control the infrastructure and to fund these projects. And what made these projects different is that, like in the early websites, the website company that made the website also produced the content, often paying writers and paying technologists and paying all kinds of people, and they produced these websites on their own with their own individual staff, right? What makes Web 2.0 about sharing is that the information is actually not produced by the owners of the website, but produced by the users of the website. So it's user-generated content, right? But the user-generated content is mediated, the communication is mediated through the central point, rather than like unmediated, like as in Usenet. And if I'm going too fast or bouncing around too much, feel free to ask questions or interrupt. It's the, right? What I'm trying to emphasize is the difference in mediation, right? So either direct communication in a peer-to-peer system or mediated communication, which is communication which goes through a third party, right? And the political economy of this is very much the same as the political economy of regular production, of other forms of production, not only of cultural production, but of production of goods, in that when the instruments of production are owned by a third party, that third party can control the productive process, either by extracting the surplus value produced or by simply controlling what can be produced and what can't be produced. So in the Web 2.0, the reason that Web 2.0 gets funding, the reason that YouTube is worth $1.6 billion in Google stock or whatever, but Usenet is worth nothing and nobody's even ever heard of it, even though it's been around since 1979, is because YouTube offers its investors something that Usenet can't do, which is control over what is expressed. The ability to collect data in an exclusive place about the people using it, and the ability to sell advertising because you have to go into a central place. So in essence, an ability to harness the creation of the value, which in the case of media normally is based on something called audience power, right? The value of media is the value of the behavioral control that the producers of media can offer. This is how advertising works. I mean, the reason that advertisers or lobbyists pay for media to be produced is because they have an interest in controlling the behavior of the people that perceive this media. So the real economic basis of media is what Dallas Smythe calls audience power, right? Which is essentially behavior control. Usenet doesn't really offer it, because how can you have behavior control in a peer-to-peer system when anybody can say whatever they want to whoever they want, whenever they want, and you don't have any middle point in which to control the flow of information, right? So you have In Web 2.0, this solves the problem. And this is what Web 2.0 is. None of the technology is particularly novel. If you look at the technology behind YouTube, there's a million other sites exactly like YouTube. There's like Dailymotion in France, and it's actually very trivial to make a site like YouTube, right? Usenet is an order of magnitude more complicated in its sharing of information, the way it distributes it around and manages the hierarchies and controls which messages exist on which servers and not. It's much more sophisticated, but that's not the point. The point is that YouTube offers investors a point of control, right? A point of a way to capture the value centrally. So what Web 2.0 is, essentially, is another business model for online communication and sharing. Not so much another technology, but another way for capitalist investment to capture the value produced, right? So the basic premise of the original websites was that you produce a site, you produce useful content or useful services, and people come to your site and you know, somehow take advantage of your services, buy your products, or look at the advertisements that fund it. In Web 2.0, the idea is that the users produce this content, right? It's private capture of community-created value by controlling the instruments of the communication process, which once again sounds very much like capitalism. Like you have the original common lands, which were then enclosed by the enclosures. So you have now a landless workforce that requires access to capital for their instruments of production, and so therefore. Their surplus value, the surplus value they produce, is captured by the owners of the land. In the same sense, you have a peer-to-peer internet in which information producers are freely exchanging information, you know, for its use value alone, and there's not really any central point in which use value can be captured. And all of a sudden, you introduce a new model. You shift the way things are funded so that now you're only funding centralized, controlled things, and you have this landless information class of information producers that have nowhere to communicate except for on these central places where then that communication, the value created by that communication, can be appropriated centrally. And that's essentially the difference between a client-server kind of a system like Web 2.0 and a peer-to-peer system like the internet. And if you look at why and how the internet got invented, the internet was really invented based on public funds. It wasn't built by the private sector. It was built by military and educational funded projects that were really developing a system that for them had use value. In the case of the educational system, the educational value. In the case of the military, you know, they were basically looking for a network that could survive, the being hit by a missile in any one place without the whole network being destroyed. So they were looking for a system of communication that was resistant to attacks for both military and academic reasons, right? It was originally commercialized by a cottage industry of private ISPs, right? These ISPs were able to sell access to this publicly funded network because of the fact that it's peer-to-peer. So because it's peer-to-peer, anybody that had access to the internet could also pass that access on to others. And so that enabled these small businesses to come up called internet service providers that sold internet accounts to the average person. And so the internet took off very, 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 very quickly. At the same time, in the capitalist world, you had these online services, like I mentioned before, like CompuServe being the most famous ones. And this worked in a completely different model. CompuServe, you had an account that let you connect directly to CompuServe, which was a one big data center, and you could communicate to other CompuServe customers on that account and use only the features presented to you by CompuServe. This was the model the private sector came up with, and this was the model that made sense to them. Because of the centralized point, once again, they have the point of mediation required to control the exchange and required to capture the value created, right? The internet didn't offer this, right? And so the first wave of internet investment was into buying up all of these ISPs. Anybody here who had an email account or an internet account in 1996 probably had an account with a relatively small internet service provider that was based somewhere in their area. Now, in 2006, if you have an internet account, if you have a web hosting account or email account, you're most likely dealing with a very large, usually the incumbent telephone companies, right? So the first wave of capitalist investment in the internet was to was to destroy the small cottage industry of ISPs and centralize control into large capital organizations to provide the access, right? But still, a lot of the applications on the internet were peer-to-peer. In the beginning, the biggest sales point of an ISP was Usenet access and email access. This is what they were selling. This is the kind of products that ISPs were selling, right? Now it's all about the web. Right? I mean, email too, but email is considered to be like very like inefficient and spammy, and email is being very much neglected. Even email is almost itself being allowed to fall apart, because really, email is also not so good. They would rather you use Facebook. They would rather you use some kind of a simple and closed and controllable thing. Right? So Web 2.0 is the second wave of information enclosure. It's the second wave of the enclosure of the peer-to-peer system, this peer-to-peer commons that the internet made possible. The first enclosure was to sort of control the on and off ramps, so to get rid of the independent service providers and replace them all with giant monolithic phone companies, right? And the second wave was to change the application, the network topologies between the applications, to be from peer-to-peer, from unmediated, from direct one person to another, to mediated through large centralized things. So the internet in 2006 looks very much like CompuServe in 1992. All of a sudden you have these very centralized points that everybody relates to, like Facebook or YouTube, and nothing else matters. And the fact that it's a peer-to-peer network is interesting only on a technical level if you're configuring routers, because in reality, you're buying your access from a giant incumbent telephone company, like, you know, I don't know what they have here, like Deutsche Telekom or whatever the telephone company is in Belgium, right? And you're all accessing the same centralized resources, YouTube, Facebook, etc. And this is the point. And as long as capitalist finance, as long as you have investors seeking to make money by owning the means of production, then the internet can only be this way, because there is no business case for private funding for peer-to-peer networks, because there's no central point of value capture. And if you look at the peer-to-peer technologies that have actually become famous, it's things like BitTorrent, Nutella, Napster, things that actually are most famous for breaking the law, for illegal activity, right? So the most advanced areas of network technology are those used by outlaws, basically, right? The actual legitimate funding, the legitimate investment is all flowing towards centralized technology. So actually, the whole peer-to-peer structure of the internet is almost unnecessary. I mean, you could easily go back to, if you have a consolidation of like Yahoo and Google, you can easily go back to one giant data center with one giant company providing individuals access and not allowing any kind of unmediated communication, right? So the mediation really has become the message. The mediation of the network is more important than media itself. Because if you look at the kinds of media that exist on Usenet, for instance, it's text, it's videos, it's the same kind of actual media, right? But the difference is not in the nature of the media, the difference is in the mediation. The difference is in what are the steps in between the communicators, right? So you have one person sending a message, another person receiving it. But what happens in the middle controls the nature of that message, who gets to send it, and what gets to be sent, right? Because in Usenet, once again, if you post a video to Usenet and your ISP doesn't like it, they can take away your account. But you can get an account at another ISP and you still access the same Usenet, the same peer-to-peer system that moves the messages around, and nobody can effectively stop you from communication. You can just hop from one account to another account and nothing's different. It's still the same Usenet that you see. If you're banned from YouTube, if your video is removed from YouTube, well, you can't see it anywhere. You're effectively prevented from communicating in that network. Same with email. If you participate with email, you can lose one email account, but you can just simply get another one. And then you can continue communicating by email. With Facebook, if you're removed from Facebook, then you're removed from the Facebook reality. So from that communication platform, you can be completely removed and never seen again. And other people that are on Facebook cannot receive your message or send you messages anymore, which can never happen in a peer-to-peer system. I think that's pretty clear, so I'm hoping that there are some questions.
I understand what you say about Facebook, mm-hmm. and similar systems, community systems, but for me, what is generally called Web 2.0, it has allowed me to be able to publish, but on my own terms. So instead of creating a website with the HTML, etc., you can also create a blog and a wiki, and so that's also, I mean,
Web 2.0 and what's commonly associated with Web 2.0 has created a very rich set of tools, which has made certain kinds of communication a lot easier. Like with YouTube in particular, all of a sudden somebody with very little technical knowledge, no desktop software of their own, can all of a sudden you know, make a video, encode it, upload it, tag it, and include it into their blog in a few seconds with no particular work, right? But that's just a question of investment in technology, right? And why has that technology been developed? Why does that technology have that level of development where it's so easy to use? Is because capitalist finance has paid for that development. And why has capitalist finance paid for that development and not the development of similar 2.0 systems, like peer-to-peer systems, right? I mean, you know, there's things like Miro, there's things like BitTorrents, there's things like Usenet. You could have done all of this with different tools. It wasn't predetermined from the start that to make it easier for you to publish, it had to be through a centralized controlled system. It was predetermined that it had to be a centralized control system because the people that paid for it, making it so easy, for the developments that brought it to you and that promoted it, had to be that way. It could have been a different way, but that presupposes that there could have been a way to fund a different way. And as long as the funding model is investors who are looking not to give money but to make money, and to make money on your production, it can't be any other way. I mean, the logic of capitalism is to increase the value of the value of property by withholding it from production, right? That's the value of capitalism, right? And in a peer-to-peer system, there isn't any opportunity to do that, because unless they can prevent you to produce, they can't put a price on allowing you to produce or to sell your audience power that you're producing to advertisers or to lobby groups or whoever they're capitalizing on that audience power, right? And that's the point. I mean, I agree that, I mean, it's much easier to publish a video online today than it was in 1995. There's no doubt about that. But that didn't come out of nowhere. That came because investment was spent on developing these tools. And this investment was directed in ways that could be centrally controlled and centrally managed.
Yeah, but I mean, even like installing your own weblog on a server is easy now.
Installing your own weblog on the server?
On your own server. I mean, I understand that there are all these blog systems.
Sure.
But it also added another layer, I find. I'm totally not Facebook, MySpace, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's not commonly, that's not, I mean, yeah. That's not, I don't refer to all blogs as like Web 2.0. I mean, it was also easy to install. Right. It was also easy to install a weblog on your server in 1996. Mm-hmm. It wasn't particularly hard.
Yeah. I mean, there. You had to know HTML and.
Pardon?
You had to.
No, that was primitive. HTML. There was primitive CMSs then as well. I mean, it was. It's not really so much about how the software is developed, and a lot of the software that's used by Web 2.0 did come out of free software. I mean, like now you have things like WordPress and stuff like that. But even WordPress, you know, movable type was around before WordPress, right? And other systems like Dave Winter's system, I forget what it's called, was around the Radio Userland stuff, was around before that even, right? So like a lot of the early stuff, even that was developed in sort of with private systems, and they realized that by opening it, they can get more users. But it doesn't really matter if you can install a blog on a web server. What matters is if you can actually generate any value there. And it's very difficult to generate value by installing a blog on a web server because it doesn't have any value until it's actually popular, until it actually has traffic, until it really has audience power, right? And in order to get this, you have to operate within a hegemonic, small, closed system of websites that promote each other, that operate themselves within a system of conferences and trade shows and like venture capital meetings and stuff like that that promote each other. I mean, why does everybody know about Google? Why does everybody know about YouTube? They know about Google and YouTube because Google and YouTube come from the centers of power. They come from venture capitalist finance projects to work within a hegemonic network of other ones that promote each other. So these things go on, like now we have things like TechCrunch and other kinds of like really venture capital organized media, online media, that promotes these sorts of things. So while sure, you know, WordPress exists and anybody can use it, even you, installing.
Watch out.
No, I don't mean that in a limiting sense. I mean, everybody can use it. It doesn't mean that you can capture value by it. It doesn't mean that from an economic point of view, you can actually make money by installing WordPress on your blog, right? And it doesn't mean that anybody reads it, right? So if you're for instance, a rock musician and you want to make rock music right? You can certainly have your own website and you can post your music on your own website, and there's a very good chance that nobody will visit it, right? But if you post your music on MySpace, for instance, then all of a sudden you can get a lot more visitors.
You also have things like Freesound, for example, and archive.org. So that's also
right. Yeah. It's by no means exclusive. Archive.org is a very interesting case. But again, archive.org is so much information that it's not.
You swamped.
Right. Exactly. But the point is not that there aren't exceptions. There are not other ways of doing things. The point is what is Web 2.0 and where does it come from? And what I'm trying to explain is that the reason that this is called Web 2.0 and the reason that online sharing has become now something that you use an online service for is because of the logic of capitalism, the logic of value capture and mediation. Right, and I completely agree that the answer to this is by doing things ourselves. But then we have to answer a lot of questions that really there aren't any easy answers for. One of those questions is how do we continue to develop software in a peer-to-peer sense without being actually paid by people that want to centralize and control power? And other ways is how do we organize peer promotion and peer forums in which people actually know about the stuff that exists there without going through the mainstream media and mediated centers of power, right? And those are questions that we don't really have clear answers yet. And so long as we're depending on capitalist investors to give us our tools, those tools will come with strings attached. Those tools will come with a predisposed center of control that allows these investors to capture the value, to control what's expressed. Have two, stereo.
This is the audience mic. So, no, I have another question about this relation between decentralization and centralization. I totally agree, for example, on your point about the fact that centralization implies a certain kind of dynamics, which is, for example, consider projects such as Delicious or Flickr, which have begun as quite free projects. I've been in the mailing list of Delicious for a bit, and I was really an enthusiast of this service. Mm-hmm. After a while, you see that it's bought by Yahoo, and it seems that apart like an evil intention, maybe this is something related also to the natural economy, to the necessity of scale that one service provider such as Delicious has to face. So let me finish.
Sorry.
So I think another problem of suggesting the way of a peer-to-peer system is that anyway you cannot ensure the same access to information. For example, consider a peer-to-peer system like Emule. Like it's very easy in a system like that to find, for example, the last movie of, for example, let's say 300. Mm-hmm. It will take not a lot of time to download it.
Right.
But it's very hard if you want to find, I don't know, a very sophisticated movie or something like, right. I don't know, a movie from the 30s. I don't know. I mean, something right. more Pierpaolo Pasolini or
right, of course.
So how you address these in a condition of an alternative media scenario?
Well, those are two quite different questions. In the second case, I mean there's a clear reason why more people want to download 300 than want to download an art film, and that's because 300 is produced by the same hegemonic capitalist system, and so a lot of money has been spent on creating the demand for 300. So even though these people are using an illegal means to share it, their original desire for it was formed because somebody spent millions of dollars to give them that desire. Whereas in the same people aren't doing the same thing for obscure art films or academic films, right? So this is the main thing. And the first question, I don't think that the question of scale presupposes centralization. It's the fact that in order to grow a company and to be big, it requires capital. And this capital doesn't come under any other terms. That's the point. You could easily have a system that scales quite well and that's peer-to-peer. What you can't have is a way to finance that system, at least not in a capitalist world. So it's not so much that to have a Delicious, it has to be owned by Yahoo. The fact is you can't have a very large bookmarking system unless it's owned by Yahoo, because the capitalist won't give you the money to fund it, to capitalize it. Even in the capitalist world, if you look at the rounds of financing that companies go through as they build, the early rounds of financing are always quite small. So you have a small group of programmers and their friends, and they make a product, and this product has some minor degree of success and attracts investment, right? When the capitalists first give them investment, they on purpose give them less than they need to fully capitalize that product and bring it to market. This requires them to keep coming back to the table. And every time they come back to the table, they give up more and more equity. Right? So the point is that in order to build a big business, it costs money. The workers have to sustain themselves. They have to pay for the capital infrastructure that they require to bring their product to market. And there's no other way to get this in a capitalist system except for dealing with venture capital. And venture capital will only give you as much as it takes to get to the next stage, that you come back for the next round of capitalist financing until the whole company is eventually owned by Yahoo. And the original founders are just essentially workers at a company owned by somebody else. Right? But it's not really a question of scale, it's a question of capitalization. And if we had other peer methods of capitalization, if we could somehow collaboratively fund projects, like there's sort of emergent areas in peer-to-peer finance and stuff like that, then you could easily have something as big as Delicious or even as big as YouTube that wasn't centralized and that wasn't centrally owned. But you still have to have some means for the workers working on the project to pay for their own reproduction costs, to pay for their own subsistence costs. And you have to have some means to purchase the actual instruments of production that are necessary to create this product. And that's where the limitation occurs, right? So if Delicious didn't sell out to Yahoo, they were just bought by somebody else, right? Or they would have just remained relatively obscure. Any other? It's okay to ask him a question too. You don't have to ask me a question. Mm-hmm. So it's also okay to ask him a question too.
No. It's kind of desperate in a way. Because you make a beautiful point, because we were sure that Web 2.0 was a business model, business right. marketing, but now we can prove it in a way to say, okay, in the point of view of technique, it's nothing new.
Right.
So thank you. That will help. The other thing is we assisted recently the last wizard of OS about making free software a business model, mm-hmm. and to prove by numbers that free software and collective intelligence makes money.
Right.
And so we were seeing how free software in Sun IBM was making millions right. of dollars, and we're completely, I say, my God. So, yeah, and after this, as users, as developers, as contributors, we participate to that capitalist economy again, mm-hmm. and what do we receive? Well, there is the license, so we can receive something. But when, for example, another panel, but they don't make the relationship, huh? mm-hmm. Talking about the fact there were no less women, less people not coming from Western Europe, Western world, being developers, they were saying, yeah, but free software is not a business, so we cannot make affirmative action, or, you know, a discrimination positive, I don't know, affirmative action mm-hmm. inside free software, because we don't have the money, or we don't have the rules to. So my question is, okay, so free software was kind of an alternative of peer-to-peer development. Mm-hmm. Actually, you're right. We working on free software, but using WordPress, having our mm-hmm. own server, but also we're made of arm. We mm-hmm. are caught in this. I try to make a point, but also I'm interested non-pure thinking. I mean, to think about an hybrid economy or hybrid mm-hmm. situation, we can't be totally out of this. Mm-hmm. So we are contaminated. Mm-hmm, we stink. All of us. We stink. But do you have any? Because this is where personally I use the fan position. To say, okay, I'm a fan. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of free software. Right, I won't never be a developer, or I'm a user, but I'm a fan. Right, fan appropriate knows that he or she stinks and mm-hmm. reuse and is growing from the marketing, growing from the capitalist system, but knowing exactly what produce him or her. But that doesn't solve the how do we make a living. Mm-hmm. So that comes back to the idea of community and right. solidarity. So everything is interlinked. So how do you do? what could be the?
You raise several points, and when you say that free software generates a lot of money, you have to start with a differentiation between what's known as use value and what's known as exchange value. And there's economically speaking, there's quite a big difference between use value and exchange value. Free software on its own has a lot of use value in that we can all use it and it does wonderful things. On its own, it doesn't have any exchange value because it's infinitely reproducible at almost zero cost. So exchange value is related to the reproduction costs of anything. Something with no reproduction cost neither has any exchange value. It may have use value, but it can't have exchange value. So in order to actually create exchange value from free software, you have to have scarce property to apply it to. So the reason that IBM is able to make a lot of money with free software is because they also have other kinds of property. This is not the only property they have. So their inputs to production also include scarce property. So because they can apply free software in the course of their production, they can capture the value, right? So for instance, in the case of a web server, Apache is a free web server that's available to everyone. So Apache itself has no particular exchange value because anybody can download it and have it. But in order to have use value, you have to have real capital in order to make a web hosting service, for instance, which is more than just simply having the software. You have to have the data center, the engineers, the interconnecting bandwidth, right? So the key to converting the use value created by free software specifically, or free culture and free production in general, is by also having in the commons scarce property. And so, unfortunately, the answer is the same old socialist answer that has been around since the beginning. The only way the workers are going to capture the value of their labor is by owning their instruments of production, especially the scarce instruments of production, right? This is the only way possible. Simply owning immaterial property cannot be converted into exchange value by any means. Right? On the sort of purity question is a very much a different question. I don't advocate anybody not use things that they need to use for that reason at all, because I mean, we don't live in a world of theory. We live in an actual existing world, and I'm completely against private landowners, but I'm not going to give up my apartments and live in a tent in the middle of nowhere, right? We have to live in the world that we live in, and we have to understand it and want to change it, but at the same time we have to participate in what exists, and we have to take advantage of what's available for us to use in the course of our own production, right? Other questions? Yes, please, more.
Okay, but so do you have some examples of, let's say, more fair information architectures which follow a bit the peer-to-peer model and on the other hand are sustainable for people who deploy the information system and for content creators? I mean, your intervention, for example, right. in the article is really strong, radical, is very clear, even in the as a negative statement.
Right.
But could we make a positive statement?
Well, I think we can, but I don't think we can simply by looking at the practices of software. I think we have to look at the production broadly. So I think really, like I said, it's the same old socialist answer as we've always had. It has to be workers' organization of production and direct ownership of their instruments of production in order to make a difference. I think you can't solve issues of class stratification with licenses, and you can't solve them with software alone, right? Software has use value, and that use value can be used in production. But I think in order for in order for you to actually make a difference, it has to be a total system. You have to actually include the scarce property and the immaterial property in some kind of mode of sharing and production that is more equitable. That's the only possible way that it can work. And so the only examples of this are relatively small. I mean, you have the emergence of anarchist tech collectives such as Telecomunistin, which I'm involved with, some Rise Up and other, you know, Mutual Aid and other very small organizations which develop free software but also offer services based on the free software they develop. So like in the case of Rise Up, they offer a whole different bunch of services, from emailing list to, and we know Telecomunistin, we're developing a telephone system that you can use to make phone calls. But I think the only way to do that is by bringing it together. So, you know, not to sell your labor, not to sell your labor power, but to sell your labor product, right? And that's the only way that you can capture the full value of that product. And it has to be total. It has to be complete. You can't just make the software and turn that directly into use value without that relationship being mediated, without that relationship going through some mediating point. And as soon as you go through a mediating point, that point is going to capture the entire surplus value of that production, and the input is never going to get any more than its own reproduction costs, if even that. Right? So the only really positive examples that are emerging now are these small groups, these technological collectives, that some of which can grow quite big, like for instance, DreamHost is a very big producer. But the problem with things like DreamHost is a lot of these things, even though they start off as sort of worker-owned, they're not by definition worker-owned. They only just happen to be worker-owned, and so as they become big, they start to develop exploitive internal relationships, right? So it has to be something that from the beginning is committed to maintaining these kind of social relationships as it gets bigger. Otherwise, it just becomes another exploitive agency, which the original founders had some kind of better situation where they own their own means of production, but then they hired employees and started to exploit their own wages.
Oh. That's good. So maybe you get the, okay. your audience now. I had a question that I wanted to ask Antoinette, actually, but maybe we can share them, but it's a bit closer to what you're asking about, because I don't know, can't find Antoinette now. Oh, there, hello. because you ended your talk with saying designers and developers of technology need to take responsibility for the technology they're developing. And that sounds like quite a thing to be put on your plate. I'm not a software developer. I call myself a designer, so then I'm somewhere in between. But I was curious how you think about this suddenly. While there's, of course, a history of this debate in how much the developers of technology are co-responsible for what is done with it. Like how much, as a developer of technology, you also design its use with it. So I'm very curious about both your response to that. So now I have to carefully not trip.
Well, do I start?
Go ahead.
Well, in fact, I don't have a definitive answer to that question, but we are in the course of an experiment at the University of Namur. We are engaged in European projects, European-funded projects, on ambient intelligence. In fact, it's not yet ambient intelligence. It's more like intelligence surveillance services, and it's beginning to become ambient intelligence. But the distinction I make between both is that for us, ambient intelligence implies learning systems. That means that profiles of users or used people are updated. And so it's a kind of aggregation of knowledge that grows, and the system responds to that aggregation. But what we try to do, and we have a good deal of these difficulties with that, is to implement that value-sensitive design I told before. That means to embark all those people who are developers of technologies, who are industrials working in the security sector, in reflecting about their own preconceptions. So we make we are designing a questionnaire that we will test on them and also on the general population to try to make them abandon their own position as stakeholders. You know, it's the problem of deliberative democracy based on, you know, the logic is that you involve all stakeholders, but the precise problem is that people should not remain stakeholders. They have to be able to take the place of the others. For example, designer of technology must imagine himself in the place of the person that will be observed. And that's what we try to do. So we hope to be able to build the scenarios of ambient intelligence together with them. But what they ask us is rather the contrary. They ask us, so tell us from the legal point of view, sociological point of view, tell us how to design the scenario so that they become socially acceptable. But that's not our job. We are not marketers. So what we try to do is just the reverse. But it's really hard work.
I mean, in principle, it makes sense to sort of expect the developers of technology to take into account their morality and their use and the best practices in their use. But in reality, it's not the developers that control development. It's the people that own the instruments of production, and the people that control the capital that developers use to produce. And once again, they have to accept direction from these capitalists and from their representatives. And also, the way development works is that it's not like there's one developer that develops a whole huge monolithic system that from the beginning to the end can imagine how it might be used and the moral implications of that, right? Developers develop a whole bunch of things that can be used in different ways by different people. But the way that they're actually used is that the way that is the capitalized ways, the ways that they have financing, and that financing comes with direction. So when developers are hired to build a website, you know, it's not the developers of the browsers and the servers that are hired, it's some other developers that are hired, and those developers are hired on the conditions that they build these websites using systems that track you or other kinds of issues that that have been raised, right? So it's not that the contributors to the Apache project can do something about the practices of people that use Apache in their service. So I don't think you can place that burden on developers, although of course it's always good to expect developers to do what they can and to be sensitive and understanding of these issues. I think that it doesn't make sense from a social point of view to expect producers to have any kind of influence over how what they produce is used in the end. This burden can only be placed on those that control the instruments of production and those that actually control the capitalization of these services, which are not interested in these things.
I was trying to ask about is, I mean, I understand, of course, as someone like a little brick in that wall, you can't be taken held responsible for the full result of your work. At the same time, it seems that it's increasingly difficult to understand, actually, for whoever is in this chain of production, what is going to happen and what is going to be the result of something put in motion here that can lead to something else. So it looks like it's actually more and more important that each of the makers in that chain take their responsibility as far as possible, however right. difficult. So, I mean, I'm trying to think about how we can prevent speaking about us and them, especially while we're facing a system right. that is somehow involving us in much more right. intense ways than which have as a result that we cannot simply cut between, let's say, saying we won't use it anymore, we were not responsible, it was not our fault, we never wanted this. I mean, this kind of position is really hard to maintain sure. yeah. right now.
Yeah. But class stratification, by definition, implies an us and them. As long as you have a system of direct producers who are producing goods and a class of owners who are simply extracting surplus value, there's always going to be class struggle, and there's always going to be an us and them. I think, in principle, I would like to see a society where we just ignore them and organize things organize things their own way, and that's of course good in principle, but that's something we have to work towards. And in reality, that's not the way that it operates. There is an us and them. There is a system of owners that control the means of production, that control the instruments of production, and a system of workers that have to sell their labor to these people in order to produce it all. In the large case. And this implies by definition that when they sell their labor, that they lose control over how their labor is used, and they lose control of the product of their labor. The product of their labor is owned by the appropriating class, is owned by the class of owners. Right. So even though it would be nice if we didn't have to talk about us and them, if we can only talk about this is our society and this is how we want to produce and this is how we want to share. In the end, we don't own our instruments of production. We may own our computers, but we don't own the apartments we live in, and we don't own the offices in which we use those computers in, and we don't own the transportation links that connect us to each other, and we still have to negotiate with those owners for access to these things. And I may be able to convince the people that I work with that we should share in a more egalitarian way. I'm unlikely to convince my landlord of this or my grocer, and so I still have to somehow. We still have to collectively somehow capture the exchange value from our labor, and in order to do that, you by definition give up the ability to direct that labor. And so even if I don't agree, if I'm a browser developer and I don't agree with tracking on the internet, if everybody in the Mozilla project refused to support cookies, then they would just hire somebody else that would do it. It's not a question of withholding. From the technologist's point of view, doesn't really change anything. What will change something is if we change the way we produce and change the way we share so that our alternative communities have enough wealth to sustain ourselves without externalities of capital input. Simply withholding certain features from the capitalists, I don't think is going to work, especially because the total number of socially conscious developers is pretty small to begin with. The vast majority of the developers that I work with, I have no concept of the social implications of what they're working. I mean, like even organizations that make missiles have no problem hiring engineers, right? So it's not that we can threaten them in any meaningful way by withholding these things. And we also can't avoid thinking in terms of class struggle, because that's what a class stratified society implies, and that's where we live, and that's what exists.
May I just I don't know, I'm not an optimist, but I'm not that pessimistic either, because I think we have to think about how science and technology is now funded, how the development is funded. For the moment, you have the European Union, for example, for our region, that takes a leading role in funding development of emerging technologies in ambient intelligence, but also all kind of information and communication technologies. And they are in the position of imposing conditions to the research consortia to receive funding, for example. And in those conditions, they can put people like us from Namur, who are really not very much liked by the developers, usually, because we are quite annoying people. But though we can notice that the dialogue is possible, and it works, and it's even from an economical point of view very useful for them to have interaction with a lawyer, with social scientists, even with historians and philosophers of science. Why is that so? Because, you know, if you develop a technology that everybody will think it's evil, that the fact that we are all here and with so many criticisms against technology makes much sense to change the thing. And the European Union has understood that and has undertaken to imply a lot of science and human science people in the development of those technologies.
I mean, I think there certainly is always cause for optimism, but while a lot of science and technology is developed in the university context, in the academic and public context, that's not where it gets commercialized and actually put into production. Before, but you know, but by the time it leaves the university laboratories and makes it into the market, it's mediated by a lot of different steps, and things are introduced in those steps. I mean, if you look at the web as it emerged from the universities, it was simply a very simple text-based thing that didn't even have pictures, let alone cookies, But then Mark Anderson founded the Netscape Corporation. The Netscape Corporation took this technology that was invented so academics could better share information and added features that made it useful for business, for capitalist investment. And so it doesn't end there, unfortunately. So maybe in the beginning in the universities you can have this context when these things are considered. Once it hits the market and once it enters market conditions and needs to be financed by capitalist finance, all of those original ideas are out the window, and they're subordinated to the needs of investors to extract wealth and to capture value. And also, I mean, there's a lot of us here today, which you pointed out, and that's good and it's great. But if you go to the O'Reilly Web 2.0 conference, there's 300 times as many people. Right, yeah, exactly, and they pay for a lot of money, right. So I think that, you know, like, there absolutely is room for optimism. I'm not being pessimistic at all, but I think that you have to look at the real politic of it, not just the discourse of it. And the real politic of it is not just in coming up with good ideas, but in getting the leverage to actually put those ideas into practice. And that is an extension of the accumulation of wealth. Political power is an extension of economic power. And until our means of cooperation, until our means of production and sharing has a collective economic power that's politically significant, then the ideas alone won't change anything. About Ubuntu? Yeah, I think Ubuntu is very nice. I'm not sure really what it changes. I mean, Ubuntu is a fork of Debian, started by a billionaire that made his they made his money by extorting e-commerce sites for secure transactions in browsers. So it's a traditional racket in the old mafia style, where you couldn't have a secure connection to an e-commerce site without paying these three companies that had their browsers. They had their certificates pre-built into the browsers, right? And now he's taken Debian, which was an existing software project that existed for a long time, and he's made a privately branded fork of it that's actually quite nice. I mean, I'm not, you know, Debian's a pretty good operating system, but I don't really see how it is a threat to class stratification or the capitalist systems of power and production. It's merely just a fairly nice desktop. And you know what, the free part of Ubuntu is exactly this use value free part that we've already discussed can't have any exchange value without access to scarce property. So in order to get any kind of exchange value to make money off of Ubuntu, you have to have access to scarce property in order to derive a business from that. Mark Shuttleworth has access to scarce property because he's a billionaire. People that download Ubuntu don't necessarily have this, so it doesn't actually change the balance of power. I mean, it's bad if you're Microsoft, maybe, because all of a sudden there's a free desktop that is considered to be easy to use and therefore could be widely adopted. But the interests of Microsoft aren't the interests of capital as a whole. It's the interest of one company that's actually very much hated by a lot of other big capitalist companies like IBM and Sun Microsystems and things like that. So. Again, it's Ubuntu's cool, but I don't really see how it changes the rules or provides any kind of like threat to the distribution of wealth. Pardon? Yeah, for sure. But again, it's use value. There's lots of use value that's generated through this process, and use value is good and worth generating. But the question is, how do you convert that use value to exchange value so that you can sustain yourself, so you can pay for your socially necessary production costs, like you can pay for your rent and you can pay for your food, right? And that's the question. I mean, the capitalists want you to have knowledge because that then you have more use value for them to exploit, right? I mean, the exploiting classes are able to extract value by controlling the instruments of production. So the more productive we are, the better it is for them, so long as we still have to be mediated by them in order to convert that use value into exchange value. I guess that's probably it. Thank you.
Thank you a lot. Et merci aux traductrices, parce qu'on les a gardées beaucoup plus longtemps que prévu. Merci beaucoup.
Marianne était là hier, donc il y a Cécile, Monique et Anne. Voilà.
Merci.
Jonathan derrière le bar. Et coiffure Liliane à la cuisine.
Voilà, voilà, et avant d'oublier, je vous annonce le prochain événement. Donc, mardi, à partir de 10h jusqu'à 6h de l'après-midi, il y a un atelier à la Compilothèque pour la création d'antennes EMF par Julien Otavi, qui se trouve là. Et le soir, le même Julien nous propose une performance qui s'appelle Light Surface. Et Alexandra, oui.